Welcome to the Father's Day. I'm Destiny Peterson. Thank you all so much for being with me. You can support the Father's Day right there by going to thefatherstay.tv/donate or locals in the description to support our work. And thank you all in advance. I have with me Professor Jason D. Hill, and he is an author and a professor of philosophy. Nice. At DuPaul University in Chicago, he has a brand new book, folks, coming out in February called Letter to God from a Former Atheist. That's amazing. Welcome to the show, Jason.
Thank you, Reverend Peterson. It's my pleasure to be here. I've seen you so many times, and it's a pleasure.
Amazing. You're so smart. I don't know if I should call you Mr. or Professor or Doctor or what. I really, you're just smart. How did you become so smart?
I think I was reading from as about the age of four. My parents plied me with a lot of books early on. So I was reading big books at the age of four or five, novels that were like 400 pages. So.
Wow. Yeah, I have a cousin. She read a lot when she was really young, and she's very smart now as well. So I guess the key to becoming smart is to start reading at an early age.
I mean, I think so. I think you build an extensive vocabulary, but more importantly, it gives you a method of thinking, of cognition, of how to process information. And I had a mother and family members who would, you know, sort of ask me questions about what I was reading. So it forces you not just to passively engage the text, but also to report and analyze what you're reading. So I do think that there's a way in which the brain is kind of wired very early on among early readers.
Very interesting. You are a professor of philosophy, right? What is that exactly?
Well, philosophy is the science, or it's the discipline that studies the fundamental principles of existence. And there are five branches. There are ethics, and I'm a trained ethicist. There's politics, so one of my specializations also is in political philosophy. And there's the branch of epistemology, which deals with the theory of knowledge. How do we know what we know? Do we know it through reason? Do we know it through faith, revelation, intuition? And there is aesthetics, which is the branch that studies the theory of art and beauty. How do we know that something is beautiful? Are there universal standards of beauty? And there's logic, which I have taught and continue to teach from time to time, which entails critical thinking, deducing, analyzing arguments, and applying meaning tests to people's or to viewpoints that we encounter on a day-to-day basis. But philosophy basically studies everything. You know, when you think of a PhD, whether it's in anthropology or sociology, it's a doctor of philosophy. So philosophy really was the first discipline that the Greeks discovered and or created, and out of that arose the emergent disciplines like anthropology, psychology, anything that you have a doctorate in, it's a doctor in philosophy. So philosophy basically studies the stuff of existence. There's also metaphysics, which I forgot to mention. People use the word metaphysics a lot, but metaphysics is the stuff out of which reality is based. You know, studies time, it studies space, and it studies matter. So it's a big field. And I'm a trained ethicist and a political theorist, and I also did a double major in English literature and focusing on the Victorian novel, and did some extensive training in psychology while I was doing my PhD, because I wanted to do two PhDs, but my scholarship ran out. So
amazing. So your mind is like, your mind, is it always busy?
Yes, I never slow down. I never stop thinking. I never stop journaling. I have about 50 journals that I've kept since I was around the age of 12. They're not diaries. They're journals that record my thoughts, record passages from books. I have a very overactive mind. I think my vocational calling, really, I knew early on, as about the age of eight, was to be a writer. And then in my teenage years, I got a calling to be a philosopher and a professor. And it's really a calling from God, although at that time when I got the calling, I was a religious child and later on became an atheist. But my mind is always active. It's always taking in everything in the world. Sometimes I feel like I don't have any membrane, you know, like I'm just perceiving everything so clearly and in a lucid manner. And it can be a burden and it can be a curse. But for me, it's been a wonderful blessing from God.
And so what will happen to you if your mind should slow down or stop? You know, you just have a normal, slow mind. What will happen to you?
I think I feel like a shark who stops swimming. I probably would drown, which means, metaphorically speaking, if I stop thinking or if my mind slows down, I feel like I'm out of breath. It's thinking and processing are as necessary to me as drinking water or breathing or eating. I was just wired that way to be a thinker, to observe, to think, to analyze. It brings me tremendous joy. And I get 8 hours of sleep a night. So it's not, you know, that I'm...
So you are able to sleep the full night?
Yes, I am.
Really? And does your mind slow down while you're sleeping?
I sometimes wonder, because I have very, very lucid dreams that where I sometimes think in another language or process information that I have been reading. But I usually wake up feeling quite rested. And the first thing I feel when I wake up is, of course, I thank the Lord for my life and for my existence. And then I plant my feet on the ground and, like the fox, I look for ground and keep on running, you know, too.
Amazing. And so do you have friends?
I have a lot of friends, yes.
You have a lot of friends?
Not a lot. I have a small inner circle of friends. And we validate and we affirm each other and we express our values through each other. I always tell people that I don't look for friends in order to gain values. I look for friends with whom I can express my values and my convictions.
And so are your friends as smart as you are? I mean, like...
Well, I never think of myself as smart. That's something that I have a very high IQ. I know that. But I never think of myself as being smart.
But the friends you have, are they like... Are they able to have the type of conversation you want to have? Or do you have to lower your philosophy mind to have a conversation with them?
Sometimes, but, you know, I've been a professor now for 27 years, and so I'm dealing with undergraduates, and I'm very, very patient, and I'm dealing with amateur philosophers and also amateur thinkers. But with my friends, I don't always have to have high-level intellectual conversations. It's more like a soul connection. You know, it's do we have the same values? Do we share the same sensibilities? Can we have conversations about life? Meaningful conversations. I sort of have those high-level abstract philosophical conversations when I'm with other intellectuals, but you don't have to be an intellectual to be my friend. You have to have a sort of intelligence and a curiosity about the world.
Right.
Yeah.
Are you married?
No, I'm single.
Have you ever dated?
In the past, yes.
And did the women have problem understanding you? I mean, like, they want to talk about nothing and you want to have real talk. Did you run into that kind of thing when you were dating?
Not really.
No?
No. No.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting, man. Are you black?
Yes, I consider myself black. I'm from a very mixed family in Jamaica. You know, I've come from a multi-ethnic family. I didn't realize I was black actually until I came to America, because there is no racial category in Jamaica where I was considered a brown man until I came to America at the age of 20 and then suddenly was classified as black. So I have no problems classifying myself as black. But I didn't have a race. I didn't have a racial identity for the 20 years that I lived in Jamaica.
Really? So you were born and raised in Jamaica, and while growing up, you had no race?
No, in Jamaica, it's based on pigmentocracy. It's based on the visual connection between your skin color and a person's perception. So my father, who's extremely, extremely light-skinned with green eyes. He was considered like a red man because his skin is as light as somebody who might be white.
Oh.
And my grandmother, who was part Jewish, part black, and part East Indian, her father was Jewish and her mother was Jamaican. She was considered a brown woman. So if you're black, it really means in Jamaica that your skin color is the color of tar. You know, they're all gradations. People are high brown or low brown or yellow or red. But there's no biological. The point I want to make is that there's no biological understanding of race.
Oh, okay. That's amazing. So it must have been pretty shocking to you to find out you were black once you got to America, huh?
Well, I had studied American history very carefully, so I knew about the one-drop rule. And still That's find amazing. It to be one of the most pernicious things that...
You have a book coming out February 2025, and your book is called Letter to God from a Former Atheist. Were you a Christian at one time, or have you always been an atheist?
No, I was quite a religious child when I was growing up. I became an atheist, I think, the year before I left America at the age of 19. I was studying a lot of philosophy and reading a lot of proofs against the existence of God. But I really think, Reverend, looking retrospectively back at my life, that when I became an atheist, a lot of that was forged in the crucibles of anger. That is, my father and my parents divorced when I was very young. So I was raised by a single mom and my grandmother, who sacrificed a great deal. But my father was, I don't know if he's schizophrenic or he's bipolar or what sort of mental disorder he has, but he abandoned our family and he certainly abandoned me. And there was a great deal of anger I felt towards God for taking away my father. My father told me quite early on when I was about 12 that he would no longer be my father. He was going to serve the Lord. And he went up to the mountains and his parents had left him some land there. And for 5 years, I never saw him. I think I cried every night for about 5 years for my father. And I had a conversion experience much, much later on, Well, let me back up. I realized that atheism was just, after about 10 years of being an atheist and accomplishing all sorts of things, my PhD, five college degrees, including a PhD, writing all these books, there was a hollowness and there was an emptiness in my soul. And I remember saying, God, I don't think you exist, but if you exist, can you grant me grace so that I can start believing in you? And I started a process of rituals where I would walk with a crucifix, I would go into churches, and I would feel sometimes the presence of God, but it would leave me very quickly. And I still realized that atheism, I had to undo this atheism. It was like, imagine not having food for like a week and feeling that pang of hollowness in your stomach. That's what I felt in my soul. And it's really true that, you know, if you are hungry, if your soul is hungry and thirsty for something, God will grant it to you, because I was granted grace and I had a conversion experience. So these letters are prayers and devotionals and prayers for other people who are suffering from addictions and suffering from all sorts of, you know, maladies in their lives. And it's really an attempt to communicate with God, to apologize to God for my hubris and my arrogance during my atheistic years, and also a way of achieving intimacy with God. The letters are very, very intimate. I think readers, when they buy this book, will see what a soul that has been deprived of God looks like when it finally comes face to face with God.
Amazing. So did you forgive your parents, your father, and your mother?
Well, my mother really hadn't. My mother was a strict mother, so there was more forgiveness towards my father for abandoning the family. My mother had no choice but to divorce my father because he was quite reckless in his spending and put my mother into a lot of debt. And nobody knew what was going on with him. People just assumed that he was reckless and he didn't seek psychiatric help. But I think I have come to the point where I understand what my father did, and I have forgiven him.
You said you have forgiven him?
I think I have, yes.
And have you told him that?
No, I have not.
And why not?
Because the timing isn't right, and because having conversations with him is a very, very difficult process. He has moments of lucidity where he sees things very clearly and perceives reality very clearly, and then he also has moments where he's psychotic. And in time, when God is ready for me to tell him that I forgive him, I will.
But God is ready for you to forgive him as soon as you realize that you resent him. And then that's when it's time to forgive. Why can't you catch him in those moments where he, I guess, is alert and forgive him so that God can forgive you?
That's a good question. We live in separate countries. I'm here taking care of my mom because she's sick with cancer, and he lives way up in the mountains. But, you know, you are right. And as we're talking, you're sort of inspiring me to make the concerted effort to seek him out and to let him know that he's forgiven for abandoning his family, his children, not supporting them financially, not really being there for them emotionally. It's a terrible, terrible, especially on, I think, young men who are rejected and abandoned by their fathers. The scars and the wounds, well, the scars heal, the wounds heal, but, you know, you bear those scars psychologically.
Well, once you go and forgive your father and your mother, then all scars would disappear and you will have a clear mind. But God cannot forgive you until you go and forgive them.
That's true. It is true.
And why haven't you forgiven your mother?
I have forgiven my mother for whatever. My mother was not perfect.
Did you tell her?
I've told her. Oh, yes.
You apologized to her for resenting her for the mistake she made with you?
I did. I have.
Oh, good.
But she's been such an incredible mother in other ways that, you know, they're trade-offs. So I have a very close relationship with her. I'm here taking care of her in her illness. And she knows that whatever mistake she made, as do all parents, that she's forgiven for them.
And what did she say when you went and said, hey, mother, I'm sorry for resenting you for the things you've done to me? What did she say when you told her that?
I think in the past when I've said that, it's been quite a while. I think she just cries or just...
She cried?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah, they always cry. I have a new shirt that says, when she's crying, she's lying. Have you noticed that when women are crying, they're lying?
Sometimes.
Amazing. So do you have perfect peace now?
I feel more freedom and more peace and serenity of mind than I have felt in decades. And I think that, of course, comes from having a relationship with the Lord. I think that comes from giving one's life to the Lord and handing over the burdens to Christ in those moments when one feels overwhelmed. But more than that, when you want to take a relationship with God, as you know, as a minister, there's a covenant or a partnership, a promise that you make. And I cultivate that relationship with God as much as I would cultivate a relationship with anyone. I have a strong prayer life. I have regular conversations with God, and it does fill me with a kind of peace and a kind of serenity and a kind of groundedness that I had not known previously. Yeah.
And do you have perfect peace?
I wouldn't say it's perfect. There are moments where my soul feels a little bit agitated sometimes, especially at the world, at my own shortcomings, at my capacity to isolate sometimes and just hunker down into my work. That's not always a good thing. I tend to have a little bit of workaholism that I ask the Lord to take care of, because I know that stems also from remnants of a void that I had when I was an atheist, in which I thought that to make myself worthy of my existence, I had to produce and achieve. I think God has told me that success is not what you have achieved, it's also what you have become. And I have become someone who is very respectful and loving towards the Lord. And so it can be a complicated process, but I think in the end, it depends on how much you stick the commitments that you've made in your life.
Do you believe it's possible to have perfect peace?
Well, I think once we inhabit a fallen state and we live in a fallen world, probably not perfect peace.
But Christ came that you might have perfect peace. Why don't you believe you can have it?
I don't disbelieve that I can't have it. I haven't gotten there yet. Remember, I'm a new convert.
Yeah.
After decades of being an atheist. And, you know, people think that when you have this conversion experience and you make your way back to God, that it's all hunky-dory. But when you have unplugged your soul, it's like plugging a light socket out of a switch for 30 years and then plugging it back in. The sparks take a while to ignite. And, you know, when I have disengaged my soul from God for such a long time, and that's why I wrote this book, Letters to God from a Former Atheist, the process of reacquainting, of getting totally in sync and achieving, as you mentioned, that sort of perfect peace will take time. So I like to think of myself as a moral work in progress. And
if you knew how to have perfect peace right now, would you accept it?
Oh, yes.
I'm sorry?
Oh, yes, I would.
Dropped your anger.
Yeah.
Dropped your anger, you can have perfect peace right now. It's right at hand. You dropped your anger?
I'm willing to.
Let me see you drop it.
Okay, I drop it.
Once you go and forgive your father, either by video or however, if he would talk to you, and once you truly forgive him, God will forgive you and give you perfect peace. The only reason human beings don't have perfect peace, they refuse to drop their anger. And they don't know that their anger is keeping them in the darkness of their imagination. And so they're like sensitive to the world. They're in the world, of the world, and they're always overreacting to something because they won't drop the anger. Anger is evil.
It is.
So overcome that anger, you'll be fine.
Okay.
Do you believe in the perfect order of God? That order of God?
Absolutely. I think just as we live in a world in which there are invariable laws of nature, like if I drop my phone anywhere in Earth's gravitational sphere, it's going to fall. I think the moral universe, I think, is as fine-tuned and as exquisite as is the physical world. There's a one-to-one correspondence. I don't think God would have made a physical world with invariable laws of nature and, you know, that works in a purely, you know, in a perfect mathematical way, yeah, and not have a corresponding moral universe to it. So yes, I do believe that, and that's one of the great challenges of teaching is dealing with the relativism of our culture that is so bankrupt and so depraved, where people do not believe that there is a fixed right and there is a fixed wrong. And
yeah. Do you believe in the spiritual order of God and Christ? Christ and man, man over woman, woman over children?
Yes, actually, I've written an article called A Return to Ethical Patriarchy, where I talk about a new manifest destiny that America needs to adopt. And in that ethical patriarchy, I do believe that males are built to lead the household and that women provide the emotional structure and the nurturance, primary nurturance of the children, and that there is an inexorable logic to that order,
yeah,
which I think feminism, radical, well, maybe it's radical feminism, but some aspect of feminism has thwarted, because we have a culture in which men are increasingly feminized and women are increasingly masculinized. and the sexes are at war with each other, and that inexorable logic of God's cosmic order is totally out of sync.
That's amazing. So I want to get into, you work in academia, and what is it like working in that field and have to deal with DEI now?
Well, you know, I'm trying not to use too strong of an, it's quite poisonous, because you want to legislate equal outcomes for everyone, and we're not all equal. We're not equal in virtue, and how do you redistribute virtue? We're not equal in physical prowess. I mean, I'm not the equal of Usain Bolt in terms of how he can run. I don't have equal in, I'm not the smartest person. But more importantly, we're not equally moral and equally virtuous. So how do you legislate outcomes, equal outcomes, when people are, in some sense, not equal at all? And I think the whole notion of diversity and inclusion is one-sided. It's diversity of leftists, an inclusion of leftist Marxist individuals who hold those beliefs, to the exclusion of people such as myself, who I consider myself an independent conservative, who hold Christian or conservative viewpoints. Those viewpoints are criminalized. And so the whole DEI shenanigan is a farce, really, because the notion of diversity, equity, inclusion should involve inclusion of multiple viewpoints that we can talk about, but it's a hydra-headed monster that includes the agenda of left-wing Marxists, who I think, in some sense, want to destroy America.
I noticed that it's ingrained into American society now. Will we ever be able to get rid of it, or is it here to stay?
Well, you can't fake reality for too long. Reality is always the final arbiter. So incompetence, you know, you have an incompetent, you use a DEI initiative and you have an incompetent airline pilot, or you have an incompetent heart surgeon, people are going to die.
Yeah.
There are consequences to these initiatives that are artificially constructed and imposed upon society. And I think when people suffer enough, and enough people die or feel pain as a result of trying to fake reality and try to twist reality according to your once perverted logic as opposed to the natural order of things, I think that will get rid of DEI organically. I don't know that it's going to take a government mandate. Those might be necessary, but I don't know that they're sufficient.
So more people have to fall from the sky, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's horrible.
It's the truth.
We should be able to get rid of it without more people having to die. But I understand what you're saying, though.
But people, you know, but the thing about it, Reverend, is that people are willfully ignorant. People are willfully self-deceiving creatures.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to hit somebody over the hammer twice in the head for them to sort of wake up.
Yeah.
Sometimes it will take people suffering, really suffering, or maybe dying. We have the medicalization, of the DEI, the medical field being infused and suffused with DEI initiatives. And, you know, we find that we're lowering standards. There's a lot of research out there to show that medical schools are lowering standards to accept minorities.
Yeah.
I know that, you know, when a brain surgery goes awry or a heart surgery goes awry or a misdiagnosis becomes a pattern and not an exception, then that's what I mean by, you know, people waking up and realizing that you can't fake reality. Reality is always the final arbiter.
That's amazing. I noticed that in the philosophy field, there's a lot of debate about free will. Do you believe that we have a free will? Human beings have a free will?
Oh, absolutely. I think it was built into the nature of humanity. I think when God created Adam and Eve, once you have the capacity to say no, to negate a consecrated order that you know to be immutable, that you know to be non-negotiable and categorical, and you go against it, you are exercising your free will. So I do think that we have a free will. We know the difference between right and wrong. We know the differences between or among viewpoints that correspond to reality. And I know that we can choose to explore the truth and pursue the truth, or we can consciously choose to live in denial of the truth and make ourselves into these mini gods, which is part of what I did when I was an atheist. You know, the world bent according to my will. And it was always about my will and what I wanted. I didn't lose my moral compass entirely, but I certainly think that I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so if human beings have a free will, I've noticed that human beings are no good, that they're evil. There's nothing in human being that is good. If human beings have a free will, why can't we be good and do good? Human beings only do evil. Why can't we will ourselves to be good and do good?
Well, these are some heavy theological questions. One answer that comes to mind is that we live in a very depraved, I call it the age of depravity, where society is completely morally bankrupt and depraved. And bad behavior sells. People are attracted sometimes to the lowest common denominator. You just look at hip-hop music and the lyrics that constitute hip-hop, and just look at the vulgarity of our culture. It's far easier to fall from grace, and it's far easier to live according to the lowest common denominator that is inside of one than it is to build what I would call an aspirational identity where you aim for moral perfection, because that takes a commitment, it takes responsibility, it takes repeated efforts. And just as it's easier to smash a beautiful vase than it is to repair one, or to make one, I should say, it's far easier to be evil. It's far easier to be bad. It's far easier to just succumb to the lowest visceral, feral aspects of human nature than to become something noble and heroic. That's too time consuming. People feel like,
no, but if you have a free will, I've noticed, and there are people who are, they love their misery, they love their hell, they don't want out. But there are those who want out of their hell, and they go to Christianity, or they go to Judaism, or Allahu Abba, or somewhere, right? And because they want to be good and do good. But even going into those religions, they're still evil. They still are no good. And even though they accept Jesus, and they pray and they cry and they read the Bible and whatever Bible, and they're still no good. Why can't those people will themselves to be good and do good if they have a free will?
Well, a couple of things. The kind of sacrifice that you have to make in your life, the delayed gratification, the impulse to not gravitate towards vice is tremendously difficult, especially, I must say this, especially in a culture that does not recognize or reward goodness, virtue, meritocracy. It rewards victimology. It rewards those who have a victim status. It rewards those who have an aggrievement mentality. It rewards the lowest common denominator. Just look at somebody like Kim Kardashian, one of the most talentless human beings that probably is on TV. And just look at the extent to which people treat celebrities as if they're moral agents. They're not moral agents. They're reproducible items or images. And so I think when there are two things. One is we don't have a culture that fosters goodness. We don't have a culture, unless you were to become a Christian nation, we don't have a culture that fosters and rewards and recognizes what one is trying to become, which is good, what one is aspiring towards, which is wholesomeness. What we have is a culture that rewards vice. And so people, I think Reverend, one of the comments I would make is that people are naturally lazy.
You can call me Jesse, yeah.
Or Jesse, I think one of the things is that people are naturally lazy.
Yeah.
And laziness reinforces your vice. Laziness reinforces your faults. Laziness allows you to remain rooted in your rottenness. And so there are very few incentives in our culture that says, look, and, you know, just look at DEI. What does DEI reward? Mediocrity. You know, slothfulness.
Well, because of time, do human beings know they have a free will?
Oh, I think they know. I think they
But for those people, if they know they have a free will, for those people who want to be good and do good, but there are people who do want it, even though they don't, most don't find it. Why can't they will themselves to be good and do good for those who really want it?
Because I think willing is not a sufficient condition for being good. I think willing is the first step in initiating a process or a series of behaviors, of actions that cultivate character over time. The other thing, too, is I think, Jesse, is that goodness is very fragile. The analogy I like to use is like a plant. You have a beautiful plant, and if it's not in amazing soil that's conducive to its growth, if it's not exposed to sunlight, if it's not watered by someone or from the rain, then the plant dies. So beauty also is a very fragile characteristic, and we do live in a culture that seems to neglect goodness. It's very difficult to be good in our society because there are too many forces in our society that institutionally rewards laziness, vulgarity, coarseness, slothfulness. So even those who are willing, willing is not enough. You can sit there and you can will all you want. You have to get off your butt and do the hard work of cultivating a moral character over time. And being very vigilant and very watchful over yourself and over your sensibilities and your habits. And it means also dehabituating yourself from bad habits that one has grown accustomed to.
Where did you get the idea that we have a free will? Where did you get that from?
Idea? I mean, I learned it in philosophy, but also from my own just Christian upbringing that God creates man with a free will.
When smart as you are, and other than Elon Musk, I don't think there's any competition other but you and Elon Musk, right? Why can't you will yourself to have perfect peace right now? To never have another sad emotional thought or feeling, to never be depressed, to never worry, to never be angry, to never be lonely, to never have fear, inward fear. Why can't you, if you have a free will, why can't you will yourself right now to be free of all that?
Well, you know, the one reason I wrote the book Letters to God is because it was like a workbook for me to literally will myself into that process. I don't think it's something that can happen overnight, especially when you've developed bad moral habits. Right, dehabituating yourself. So I am a work in progress. I am someone who's trying to will myself and not just will myself, but to follow through on what I'm willing, which are certain actions and how I comport myself in the world, how I approach people and how I approach God. And that is a commitment that I intend to honor. That is a commitment that I intend to spend the rest of my life trying to achieve.
God said that of ourselves we can do nothing. Of ourselves we know nothing. We know not what we want. We know not what to even ask for. Why would he say that if we had a free will? Why would he tell us we don't if we had one? We can't even change ourselves. We have no control of anything. And if God said it, why would we want to believe we have a free will when he said we don't?
I don't know that he says we don't.
We can't do nothing of ourselves, right?
Not by ourselves.
And of ourselves, we know nothing.
Well, we need the aid. We need the help of God.
But if we have the free will, why do we need his help?
Because we're finite, because we're mortal, because we're also fallen creatures, and we are fallible creatures. We're not infallible. We're bound to make mistakes. And I do believe that there is a, just in the same way that somebody can go to a gym and over time work out and develop muscles and a healthy body, there is a moral workout practice that we can inhabit in our lives with the help of God, that, and with the aid of our free will, that is, we have to choose to want to be good. When you said that lots of people are willing and they sit there willing, I'm not sure how authentic and strong they are in that willing process, in the sense that they want to have their cake and they want to eat it as well. And you can't have both, right? So you can't just sit there and will to be good, but are not doing the attendant actions and reforming your behavior in a manner that's consistent with your willing. So there's an inconsistency there. Lots of people are willing all sorts of things and they want to be good, but they're not doing the corresponding actions that over time lead to what you probably would call a morally perfect character, which, or to be fulfilled, or to never be sad, or never to be alone again. The sort of commitment that is required, and the kind of vigilance, again, I go back to the word vigilance, that one has to exercise, are just things that people don't want to commit themselves to, because you have to give up a lot. You have to sacrifice a lot to be a good person.
Amazing.
There are a lot of, you know.
Amazing. You know, I got to ask, you work, and I was thinking about you as I prepared for the show today, you work amongst a lot of educated women, right?
I do.
My heart goes out to you, because I've noticed that the more educated women are and become, the worse they get. It seems as though their ego goes out of control and they become pure evil. How do you handle that evil that comes through those women that are educated and dealing with them every day like that? How do you deal with that?
I guess I don't see it in a strong a term as you see it. I know what you mean, in the sense that education breeds a kind of hubris and a kind of arrogance, and it strays you from your lane, the lane that you were destined to pursue as a particular sex. You know, whether you're male or you're female, we have written articles about this. We, with the rise of transgenderism and so on, we have our gender, we have certain responsibilities that come with our, I don't like the word gender, with our biological sex.
Right.
That God assigned, that God made us. And so I find that it's not just a problem with women, it's a problem with men also, in the sense that the more enlightened and the more smart or intelligent that you are, or the more learned that you are, the more you're likely to sort of deify yourself and commit a form of self-idolatry.
Yep.
by making yourself into a kind of god.
Working around women like that, how do you handle that? I mean, are you just, do you like stay in the corner, or do you, what is it like for you having to be around that spirit? Because it's such a wicked spirit. How do you deal with that?
With a great deal of compassion, I suppose, when I see anyone who takes advantage of their knowledge or their intelligence or their education and use it as a cudgel to two things. Uses the cudgel to badger men into submission, which is what I think is sort of rampant in our culture right now, especially among boys, where masculinity is criminalized and masculinity itself is regarded as toxic. Not there used to be toxic masculinity and then there used to be masculinity. No, all forms of masculinity are toxic.
According to those evil women.
Well, but Jesse, we can't, just can't blame it on women. There are a lot of beta males out there who...
Oh, yeah, a lot of beta male. You're right.
There are a lot of beta males who love being beta males because it requires them to relinquish their God-given responsibilities to comport themselves, to behave in a certain way, to be leaders. And being a leader and assuming that leadership position demands something of you that a lot of men would rather not have. Men have become lazy. Men have become recalcitrant in their roles that they were designed to play. And so I don't see this as a female problem. I see this as part of a condition that has emerged since the Enlightenment, right? Since we have democratized education for all and everybody feels that they're entitled to an education and everybody feels that they're entitled to their opinions and that people elevate their stupid opinions to the level of human knowledge. I see that wickedness that you're talking about being allocated among or between the sexes quite equally, because nothing infuriates me more than when I see a young boy who's rambunctious and breaks things and wants to put it apart, gets labeled as toxic or destructive. You know, when I hear talk about the patriarchy, we need, my sense is that we need more ethical patriarchy, not less patriarchy in our world.
Absolutely.
So maybe I differ with you on that, and that I see that there's a collusion between the sexes.
Well, the one thing I know for sure, without a doubt, is that women hate men. They hate their fathers. They hate men. And that's why they're constantly trying to weaken the man. They tell him he can be like a woman, he can wear ponytails, he can wear earrings, he can change his sex, which is a lie. But they say he could, they're always trying to devalue men. And the reason for that is because the God above is the man's God, and the God below, which is Satan, is the woman's God. And that God, the God below, hate the image of God in men. And so the woman is constantly trying to degrade and destroy the image of God by destroying men. You even see it in the home. Mothers turn their sons away from their fathers by playing victim and saying how bad the father was. But they never tell you, I ran your father off. He didn't know how to handle the health in me. They pretend that they're the victim. And so they are constantly turning the boys away from their fathers, and the boys take on their identity, the same spirit as in the mothers and now in the boy and the girl. And so they hate the male image because it is an image of God. Have you noticed that?
Well, it's part of our secular culture, Jesse. I mean, it's one has to notice that because it is part of what happens in a secular society in which the sexes, rather than being... See, I'm a more of a complementarian in my approach to the roles between the sexes as opposed to an egalitarian, in the sense that I think they complement each other. And when you live in a society that has taken away from men all the responsibilities, all the actions, all the rites of passage, I should say, that bend him towards masculinity, it's hard not to notice. And
just the power is in the man and not in the woman. The woman have no power at all, zero, because Satan is her God and Satan has no power. Why do men give up their masculinity so easy to the woman or because of the woman when the real power is in the man and not in her?
Well, You know, this is a deeper cultural issue, because we do have a society. I think once you have a society that is predicated on egalitarianism, that treats the sexes identically and do not recognize God-given differences between men and women, for example, you are bound to have a faulty socialization process under which men are governed. And it's partly cultural. It's also partly individual, in the sense that we just live in a society where people are relinquishing their responsibilities left, right, and center.
Amazing. And
those responsibilities that they know come from a higher source, they know come from God. It's far easier to not align oneself with God's will, but to somehow be lazy and just back out of your responsibilities. I mean, look, there's this, I will just give you one example. There's this man I've been giving money to for 27 years. He's on the street. He's always, I don't know if he's homeless but he's got his little, you know, cup shaking it. And every so and then I give him $5. And I've known him for 24 years, because he stands outside the Walgreens and outside my university. And I just said to him, you have children? And he said, I have 12 children.
Whoa.
And he started bringing his children, his young sons, along with him. And one of them, when I was giving him money, was so ashamed, he hid his face between his hands like that, because he didn't want to look at me giving his father money. You know, so I think also we live in a society where men also have to be accountable for their behaviors as well, that if you can't be a homeless person or a street beggar, really, and father 10 children.
But why do you keep giving him money knowing you're hurting him and not helping him? Why do you give him anything?
I guess I feel sorry for him.
But that's not love. You're not supposed to feel sorry for anyone. God did not give us the right to feel sorry for anyone. We're not God, right? But you're feeling sorry for him is what is helping to destroy him. That's what mothers do to the children. She feels sorry for them, and in return, she destroys them. So you're feeling sorry is hurting him rather than helping him.
Well, I'm not clairvoyant. I don't know what he does with the money. He's got, you know, not that I know, he has 11 children, and he's bringing them around. I don't know. I guess I'm just habituated as a Christian. A new lamented Christian. And even before I was a Christian, I sort of had this spirit of generosity, where I feel like if you see someone in need, you don't know what they're going to do with the money. I don't know that he's going to buy liquor. I have no reason to think he's a drug addict. If I think that he can do some good with it, and it's not costing
him that
much.
He's not going to do any good with it. Mark my word. Bakers don't do good with money. But let me ask, I say to men that they should not marry an educated woman. That educated women do not make for good wives and mothers. Do you agree with that?
Not necessarily. I think, because I've met a lot of educated women who are traditional wives.
No, they're giving their husband hell, and they don't care about the children.
I wouldn't want to sort of. I mean, I do think that children are getting a raw deal, because their upbringing is being outsourced to the horrible public education system that we have.
Because educated women have no love. They don't love their children. They don't love their husbands. They don't love God. They only love their ego. They love their father, Satan. And everything is about them. They can care less about their children or anyone. And that's why they don't make for good wives and mothers.
Well, some do, some don't.
Marry an educated woman? Be honest. Not that you're dissing, but would you ever marry an educated woman?
I've never thought about it.
You haven't even thought about it. And you work around them.
I don't know that education per se is the enemy. I think it's your will, and it's your intention, and the intention that you bring to any relationship that you're in, that really, for me, that really counts.
Because of time, I have to move a little bit faster here. a lot of young people believe that college is a scam now. Are they right about that?
Well, I have argued that the universities should be defunded, especially the humanities departments, because they are nothing but left-wing bastions for radicals to propagate ideologies that are totally inimical to the well-being of our country. Marxism, communism, socialism. College has become a scam because we are not teaching people how to acquire the skills that they need to survive in the world, which is part of what a college education does. It does, for me, it does two things as someone who's been an educator for 27 years. It gives you life skills that enables you to navigate the world. And it also helps in cultivating your moral imagination. It cultivates your moral character. It's part of broadening your sense of understanding of the world, of other people. And it ought to build a sense of compassion and moral, right compassion, not false syrupy compassion, where we use compassion to excuse bad behavior. So to answer your question, I think college has become a scam, because I don't think that we're really educating our young people.
What a mess.
It should be.
That's amazing. So I got to ask, you wrote a book called What Do White America Owe Black People? Racial Justice in the Age of Post-Oppression. What's wrong with the blacks?
Well, you know, there was a book that I wrote before that called We Have Overcome, an Immigrant's Letter to the American People. So this book is a sort of follow-up. And I've gotten a lot of pushback from black Americans who consider themselves foundational blacks, who have written to the president of my university telling him I should be fired. There's a movement right now among foundational blacks, the organization that's called Foundational Black Americans, to have me fired from my university because I have dared to say that reparations are not a good idea.
Right. I agree.
That there are a couple of things going on. One is there's no personal life today who is a slave, and there's no personal life today who is a slaveholder. So the whole notion of ancestral guilt is quite evil. I wouldn't want somebody blaming me for a crime that a black man has committed because I share the same ascriptive identity as he does. And I don't think that it's factually correct. Most of the whites who are in America today arrived here after the Civil War. And I also argue further that the 1964 Civil Rights Act was a reparative moment in American history. It brought blacks into the full pantheon of the human community. That's the reparation that black Americans got, was the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which outlawed racism, made discrimination illegal, and it granted full citizenship, full, what I call the inalienability clause, are now exercised by all blacks. There's nothing more that a free state can do to black Americans without becoming totalitarian, without becoming communistic, without becoming authoritarian, right? Blacks, there are no rights that whites enjoy today, Jesse, that blacks don't enjoy.
Yep.
So I don't know what extra rights and extra privileges one could accord to black people without discriminating adversely against white people.
Amazing. Why are white people afraid to tell the blacks how the cow ate the cabbage?
Well, there are two. My observation is twofold. One is that there's a cabal of white liberal do-gooders who are quite sadistic. That is, they're a kind of managerial class that have convinced black people that they're victims, that we live in a systemically racist country, which we do not. It's not systemically racist anymore, as it was under Jim Crow or under slavery, and that they can't use their creative agency to make something remarkable of their lives, that this managerial class of white bourgeois liberals are the only ones that can help them against the evil white man. So there's that problem. Then there's the other problem of conservative whites who actually know what the truth is, but are deathly afraid of being punished for speaking the truth. They're afraid of being called racists. They're afraid of being called white supremacists. So it's a lot easier to just sit there and accept unearned guilt and to say nothing, or the flip side of that, as I've mentioned, is to be part of this managerial class that has paralyzed Black people. Black people are among the most innovative people, if given the chance, and creative. Just look at how Blacks survived slavery. Just look at how the thriving communities that existed on a Jim Crow and industries. And the marriage rate at one point in the 1950s, I think, among Blacks far surpassed, not far, but it surpassed the marriage rate among whites. So we know that Black people can achieve, have achieved in the past. Yeah. Have look at, you know, the Black Wall Street, the Tulsa phenomenon. But we have a liberal white supremacist class. If there's white supremacy in this country, it's among the liberal white supremacists who want to keep Black people down because they have to be in charge of someone.
I grew up under the Jim Crow law back in that time down in Alabama. And I now know the worst thing that ever happened to the Blacks, other than abortion itself, was the Civil Rights Movement. I am 100% convinced, had not the Civil Rights Movement ever happened, Blacks would be better off today than they are, because they would have maintained self-reliance, self-independence. They would have worked for themselves. They knew that the battle was good versus evil. It had nothing to do with color. And had not the Civil Rights Movement happened, the Blacks would be real Americans today instead of blaming and begging and allowing other people to control them.
Mm.
What a mess.
Yeah, but it's a mess. It's a mess.
So listen, I got to put you on the hot seat. We're out of time, so I got to put you on the hot seat. I need you to answer these questions as quickly as possible.
Okay.
You ready?
I'm ready.
The hot seat.
What is love?
Love, fundamentally, I think, is a response to the values and the convictions of another person.
Is it ever okay to call a woman fat?
If she's facing health problems, yes.
What is a man?
A man is a biological male who has achieved adulthood and assumed, I think, certain responsibilities to lead, to govern, and to leave an enduring and lasting legacy in the world.
Do you agree that white Christian men are the most hated species on this side of heaven?
I don't know if they're the most hated species. I know that they are hated and that they get a lot of unfair blame attributed to them for the problems of a lot of other people.
Is the earth flat or round?
I think we know the answer to that. It's certainly not flat.
Do we need more white babies?
We need more America. We need more. I don't know if we need more white babies. We need more Christian people having children in this country who will produce naturally and organically.
True or false, slavery is worse than abortion?
No, I think they're, if one believes in, I think they're equally evil.
Which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Which came first, the chicken or the egg? I think the chicken came first.
Have you ever seen a ghost?
No, I have not.
Does a chicken have lips?
No.
Is climate change real?
To some extent, I think it is real, yes.
True or false, sending your kids to a public school today is child abuse?
Yes.
Have you ever told anyone how the cow ate the cabbage?
No, not really.
Does a bear shit in the woods?
Oh, yes.
Did you have fun?
I had a blast with you. I'm a little surprised at how the interview took form, but you know, I roll with energy. So I really had a lot of fun with you.
When you said, what do you mean by you surprised how it took form the way it went? What do you mean by that?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me a bunch of questions about like real technical questions about reparations and about, you know, the technicalities and logistics of reparations.
Oh, I see.
I was surprised how you started off the interview in a very sort of almost loving way about my background and my affirmative way about my background and my life. That was surprising and enjoyable.
Right on. Well, it's an honor to meet you and it's an honor to talk to you. And tell the folks how to get your books, your writings, your website, whatever you want to put out there.
Well, you can go on Amazon and you can, because that's where the books are discounted. I mean, so I would love if people got the new book is coming out in February, but they can pre-order it. Letters to God from a former atheist. That's on Amazon. It's available for sale. And they can get my other books. I've written 6 books, but they can get the other 2 that I think are really important for right now, which is What Do White Americans Owe Black People? And We Have Overcome, an immigrant's letter to the American people, which is a love letter to America. And it extols the greatness of this country. I think America is the most moral and superior country on the face of the earth. I lay the foundation, the conditions for that in the book.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for coming on. Let me ask real fast, have you read the Bible all the way through?
I did as a child. My religious upbringing demanded that I read it. So now I'm, as a new convert, I'm making my way through it slowly.
And did it do you any good to read the whole Bible?
Oh, yes.
What good did it do
almost
you?
Almost certainly. Even when I was an atheist, I never lost my moral compass, as I said, because as an early child, I was raised in a Christian household with a grandmother and mother who took me to church every Sunday, went to a Catholic school, had Bible studies. And so even when I decided to become an atheist, there was still that religious ethos that was in some way governing my actions in the world.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. I noticed that mothers destroy their children and then they take them to church. Isn't that amazing?
It is. You find that's what they do. Well, Jesse, I'm thankful for my mother because without her, I probably wouldn't be sitting here talking to you and having this conversation.
Right on. Amazing. Yeah. Well, thank you for coming. Thank you all for tuning in. I absolutely appreciate it. Don't forget to go to thefatherstate.tv/donate or locals.com. And don't forget to like, follow, ring the bell, subscribe. All that good stuff. And if you have others you would love to see on The Father State, contact my producer@thefatherstate.tv. And Merry Christmas. I forgot to tell you Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas to you.
Same to you, Jesse. Merry Christmas and God bless you.
You too, buddy. And to all of you out there, Merry Christmas. Thank you again. Take care. Amazing.